I first started doing philosophy, I didn't really know what I was doing. Some will say that not much has changed. And it is true that I don't have a worked out metaphilosophy. It's still the case that I'm flummoxed by innocent questions about what I do. On airplanes, I used sometimes to lie and say that I was a nurse or a lawyer or something else that people could recognize, but I eventually found that if all I want is for my neighbor to leave me alone, it's far more effective to tell them the truth. I'm a philosopher. Yes, let me explain my theory of mental causation to you. Works like a charm every time. But even if there are many big questions about philosophy that I cannot answer, I still do think that I've gained some insight into what philosophy is, or at least what it could be, or what it should be. I had the enormous good fortune as a beginning student of philosophy to fall under the tutelage of some extraordinary philosophers, as well as some extraordinary teachers who were not philosophers, for example, the flutist John Obergrunner. My very first philosophy teacher, and perhaps my harshest critic even to this day, is Peter van Inwagen. He paid me the immense compliment of taking me and my questions and my objections and my arguments and even my confusions seriously. He validated my inchoate conviction that things ought to make sense, and that when they didn't, you had every right to ask questions. A lot of times in my early life, I expect this is an experience that I share with many people in the audience, a lot of times in my early life, I felt like a freak for asking questions that no one else seemed to think needed answers. Why should unbaptized babies go to limbo? Why does Santa Claus give more presents to rich kids than to poor kids? My interest in that particular question, I have to say, was not purely intellectual. In graduate school, I was fortunate to have such luminaries as Hilary Putnam, Jerry Fodor, and Ned Block as interlocutors. These philosophers demonstrated to me the power of philosophical imagination and the unexpected richness of everyday phenomena. I was also privileged to be able to attend lectures and seminars by Noam Chomsky, who surely stands to contemporary cognitive science as Einstein stands to physics. Influential as these figures were, however, I can see now, looking back over my career, that the dynamic that was to drive almost all my philosophical projects was set by my reading the works of Willard Van Orman Quine. In particular, I was mightily influenced by Quine's arguments for what he called naturalizing epistemology. I did not take Quine's view to be, as some do, a rejection of normativity in the theory of knowledge, nor did I take it to be a brief for the methodological primacy of the natural sciences. He did want to put philosophy under empirical constraint. That's what he meant by saying that there's no first philosophy, but that is not the same thing as saying that philosophy should be eliminated in favor of something else. What affected me deeply, I think, was the idea that philosophizing should be continuous with other ways of coming to know the world. If philosophers are studying knowledge and psychologists are studying knowledge, surely each group's findings are pertinent to those of the other. This idea of continuity and mutual constraint brought together in my mind not only philosophy and science, but philosophy and everyday beliefs. As I just mentioned, I had worried as a child about things like limbo and Santa Claus, stuff that I had been told was true, but that didn't seem to make any sense to me. It irritated and saddened me that adults seemed to dismiss my questions, that they gave me the impression that there was something wrong with trying to make sense of all the things that I was being told I ought to believe. I didn't understand. If justice was treating people fairly, ensuring that they did not suffer for things they did not do, and if God was just, why did he deny heaven to innocent babies just because they were not baptized? It wasn't their fault they weren't baptized. How could it be just that they were punished? Are there two kinds of justice, justice for us and justice for God? Why are they both called justice then when they seem to be so different? Okay, I sort of slipped that in. I'm not going to pretend that I've just produced the definitive version of the argument from evil. I do think, in fact, that the extent and distribution of suffering constitutes a decisive argument against the existence of God, but that's not the point that I'm trying to make right now. There are responses to the challenge I just raised, and if my topic were actually the problem of evil, I would consider those responses and tell you my responses to them. But my topic here is really continuity, the mutual relevance of claims of truth in one domain to claims of truth in any other. With your indulgence, then, what I'd like to do is describe three different ways in which continuity, the central idea of naturalized epistemology, has played out in the determination of my own philosophical interests. And I do ask your indulgence. I have to confess that whenever someone lists the various topics that I've worked on, I worry that it means that I just have a very short attention span. So I'm hoping with this exercise to convince myself as well as you that there is some kind of unity to my work. Okay, way number one, Quine versus Quine. Quine's arguments in Two Dogmas of Empiricism are directed at the positivist program of rational reconstruction. We start with the question, what justifies scientific theories? A reasonable first answer is that scientific theories are justified by observations. Why are observations capable of justifying beliefs? Because they're composed out of sensory data that reflects the character of the external world. They are impingements, as Quine liked to call them, upon our sensory surfaces, and the character of these impingements is determined by the character of the external world. Insofar as our observations are determined by these impingements, and insofar as our theories are determined by our observations, we have an explanation of how the theories can be expected to correspond to the nature of the external world. But of course, this answer needs a lot of elaboration. There are two big problems. To begin with, there's the problem of underdetermination. The amount of sensory data available to any scientist, even through the course of her entire life, is paltry compared to the richness of the theories she develops on its basis. And this problem for the scientist is just the problem in second intention that every human being faces when constructing his or her own theory, his or her set of commonsensical beliefs about the external world. The second big problem is that the actual construction of scientific theories does not usually, if ever, follow the neat and direct causal path suggested by these opening considerations. Sometimes hypotheses are triggered by occurrences that have no evidential bearing on the matter at hand. Sometimes evidence that does bear is neglected or discounted. The actual route from sensory evidence to scientific theory is meandering at best, full of false starts and dead ends, with progress often dependent on dumb luck. It has to be conceded, then, that the actual story about the relationship between sensory data and scientific theory is not going to be epistemologically ideal. Still, the thought is, that if the content of scientific hypotheses could be shown to be constructible in principle from sensory evidence that is available in principle, that would show how, in principle, science could correctly mirror the world. Quine famously had telling criticisms of this program. He asserted that its viability depended upon principles that could not be defended, what he called the two dogmas of empiricism, the analytic-synthetic distinction and reductionism. But I want to focus on a different criticism, still Quinean, but one that's independent of the technical problems with positivism. This is the criticism that the program of rational reconstruction could not possibly fulfill the purpose that inspired it. If the question is, how might theory be built out of sensory data in principle, then the only issues are the technical ones. But if the question is, what justifies belief in actual science, then the project of rational reconstruction is irrelevant. There are no questions after this, right? In a criminal trial, it matters little if the prosecutor would be justified if the defendant's fingerprints had been found on the murder weapon. But the opposite question is, given that the fingerprints were not actually found in the murder weapon, what warrants the prosecutor in pursuing the case? Similarly, it matters little if we can characterize an ideal way for theory to be justified on the basis of sensory evidence. What we want to explain is how non-ideal science works so well. What we need to know is how, on the fragmentary and paltry evidential basis we are in fact limited to, do we ever manage to produce the science that we do? As Quine said in one of my favorite passages, which I do my best to quote in almost every paper I write, why all this creative reconstruction? This make-believe. Since the challenge of scientific theorizing was, as I said earlier, simply a special case of the problem of empirical knowledge, Quine's recommendation was to transform the study of empirical knowledge generally from a project of a priori idealistic construction into a project of realistic explanation. Start with our most obvious cognitive achievements, science for example, and figure out how these achievements were possible given the constraints that define the human epistemic condition. Now, it seemed evident to me at the time in the late 1970s was that the theories of language and mind that were coming out of MIT, and really coming out of Harvard as well, given the fundamentality of Hilary Putnam's work on functionalism, these theories seemed to me to be doing exactly what Quine was urging us all to do. Chomsky, for example, began his theorizing about language with the naturalistic question how a human child could acquire a complicated system of symbolic communication under the conditions in which children routinely performed this feat. The central point to be explained for Chomsky, as for Quine in his critique of positivism, was underdetermination. The child's linguistic data were fragmentary relative to the rich content of the linguistic system the child managed to acquire, typically within the first 4 years of life. How then was language acquired? Linguistics naturalized. Quine, of course, did not see things this way. He argued that the underdetermination of language by data was different in kind from the underdetermination of physical theory. The underdetermination of language was, he maintained, a second level of underdetermination above and beyond the underdetermination of physical theory by sensory evidence. Fix the physical facts, he said, fix the theory that one used to capture the facts in actuality, and the linguistic so-called facts floated free. That's how he argued. But his argument, ironically, contained the same fundamental flaw he had identified in the positivist program of rational reconstruction. It was built on make-believe. Quine made his case for this view in his infamous argument for the indeterminacy of translation. The argument relies vitally on the following assumption, that whatever facts about language there are must be rationally reconstructible on the basis of facts about the environmental contingencies of language use. This assumption, however, is just as unmotivated and just as problematic as the positivist assumption that scientific theory can be reconstructed on the basis of sensory data. From the fact that the positivists were unable to reconstruct science under the strictures they had imposed on themselves, Quine did not conclude that there was no fact of the matter as to whether scientific theories were true or false. Quine claimed that language was different, however, because it introduced this additional level of indeterminacy. Physical fact might be underdetermined by sensory evidence, but linguistic fact, he said, is left unfixed by what he called all the physical facts. The argument is persuasive, I think, until you realize that Quine is operating with a proprietary conception of all the facts. You'll recall that his radical translator was given a constrained database to work with. The would-be gavagologist was allowed to report the environmental circumstances in which the native informant either asserted, affirmed, or denied sentences in her language. But the translator was not allowed access to lots of other physical evidence that one, physical information that one might think could be pertinent. In particular, the translator was denied evidence about the native's brain states or psychological states, and no behavioral level evidence about the child's course of, the native children's course of acquiring their language either. One important and telling exception, Quine did grant the gavagologist knowledge of the behavioral signs of agreement and disagreement. I say this exception is telling because it highlights the in-principle dependency of any actual attributions of meaning on assumptions about the speaker's mental states. If the gavagologist has not spotted this assumption, that is, that he can recognize when the native agrees and disagrees, the gavagologist project would not get off the ground. Once we recognize the importance of this bit of psychology, we may also begin to see how much Quine is taking for granted about the motives of the native informant. Anthropologist Derek Freeman charged that much of the polymorphous perversity reported by Margaret Mead in her study of the sex lives of Samoans was based on bullshit, and I use this term in its strict Frankfurtian sense. Bullshit pitched to her by her native subjects for their own amusement. I suppose it did not occur to me that her informants would be anything but sincere and forthcoming. Now, we're not told the ethnicity or race of Quine's native informants, but his narrative does rather encourage the colonialist picture of indigenous people as simple folk, unfettered by their own projects and responsibilities, and warmly cooperative with the unintelligible product of this perfect stranger. I invite you all to see if it makes a difference to your assessment of Quine's argument to imagine that it's English that's being radically translated and that you yourself are the native informant. How would you react to a guy with a notebook following you around all day, periodically pointing at animals and growing, rabbit? Rabbit? But I digress. The point is this. The evidence that Quine permits his radical translator to work with falls short of all the physical facts. It does not, as I said, say anything about psychology or neurology, facts that it's not implausible to assume have something to do with determining the properties of the language the native is speaking. The only justification Quine offers for this particular selection of fact is the thought that these must be the facts that determine the course of language acquisition. They are, he assumes, the only ones available to a human child when she is learning her native language, and the only ones available to the child's adult tutors who are shaping the child's emerging linguistic abilities. Quine writes, "The sort of meaning that is basic to translation and to the learning of one's own language is necessarily," Quine said necessarily, "is necessarily empirical meaning and nothing more." And Quine continues, "A child learns his first words and sentences by hearing and using them in the presence of appropriate stimuli. These must be external stimuli, for they must both act on the child and on the speaker from whom he is learning. Language is socially inculcated and controlled. The inculcation and control turns strictly on the keying of sentences to shared stimulation." But if the criteria for inclusion in the database is really what's available to a child learning language, then surely the author of Naturalized Epistemology would do a little empirical investigation to see what actually is available to the human child as she acquires linguistic competence. Remember, why all this make-believe? Surely Quine would do what Chomsky did, study the actual circumstances in which children pick up their native tongue. But no, he did not. Now, when we do look at the results of empirical study, we'll notice something surprising. I've been complaining that Quine unjustifiably restricted the body of fact on which his radical translator could draw. But it turns out, not only did Quine give his translator too little information, because Quine is right, the behavioral dispositions do not fix the linguistic facts. In addition to giving his translator too little information, he also gave his translator too much. Quine gives his radical translator access to all possible behavioral data. If the translator is deliberating between two alternatives for translation of a native construction, and if the matter can be settled by empirical test, Quine generously provides the results of such tests to the translator's body of evidence. So consider, for example, an example that I'm borrowing from Lila Gleitman. Consider the pair of verbs chase and flee. For a very large range of circumstances, it's the case that if one of these verbs is appropriate, so is the other. Whenever the hounds are chasing the fox is fleeing the hounds. This sort of situation poses an in-principle problem for the real-life language learner. The observed contingencies of use for these two verbs are apt to be identical. And it doesn't help to point out, as Steven Pinker does in reply to Gleitman, that there are contexts in which one of the verbs but not the other is suitable. For example, I can flee the city, but the city doesn't chase me when I do so. The counterfacts cannot help the child. If the child never actually encounters such circumstances, the evidence they would provide cannot be part of the child's database. If Quine were consistent in his rationale for excluding information about neurology and cognitive psychology, he ought also to have excluded evidence that the translator might have but did not actually obtain, just as the positivist were being too generous and giving the scientists access to sensory data that would bear on their theories, but that they did not actually have. There are other bits of generosity on Quine's part that have no grounding in the actual circumstances of acquisition. One, the human child does not have the pedagogical equivalent of the translator's native informant. Children receive virtually no explicit feedback on their linguistic efforts, and when they do, they ignore it. This is a scientific finding, verifiable by any parent. Now, I should say, as an aside, it is a matter of controversy whether the child's environment does or doesn't contain enough information for the child to learn the grammar of her native language purely on the basis of the stimulus. Since Chomsky, there's been a lot of fine looking at the circumstances of acquisition, and there have been some interesting things that have emerged that suggest there's more information there than maybe Chomsky thought there was in the first place. But the current point is that Quine does not even ask the question what data are actually available to the child. Second thing, a large percentage of the child's early linguistic data consist of questions and imperatives. It is of the nature of these sorts of sentences that they are uttered in the absence of their subject matter. Generally, it's closed doors, windows, and mouths that we ask people to open. The third, the verbs that occur most commonly in adult speech and which are among the first for children to acquire are also the most general. It is hard to think of a circumstance in which it would not be appropriate to use some form of do, make, have, or be. These considerations are, of course, all part of Chomsky's poverty, the stimulus argument for the existence of innate linguistic knowledge. But that's not my point at the moment. I'm making an ad hominem against Quine. I'm charging him with being insufficiently naturalistic. He draws ontological conclusions about the domain of language from a thought experiment that proceeds from theoretical suppositions about how language acquisition ought to proceed. He did not conclude from the failure of Carnap's project in the Aufbau that empirical science is indeterminate, that there's no fact of the matter which of two apparently conflicting scientific theories is correct. He concluded only that if we want to understand how we manage to make sense of the empirical world, we must do so by working within the constraints that define the human epistemic condition. But focus on the actual characteristics of the human epistemic condition is the whole point of naturalizing epistemology. Chomsky, as I said, used the poverty of the stimulus argument to argue for the existence of innate information that the human child brings to the task of language acquisition. Quine himself certainly appreciated the need in general for substantive, pre-theoretic, or as you might as well say, a priori elements in explaining the development of human knowledge in general. He just didn't see it in the case of language. Quine pointed out, for example, that induction cannot be performed unless there is in the learner an innate similarity space, that's his phrase, that determines the parameters of generalization. In collaboration with Joseph Ullian in The Web of Belief, Quine acknowledged the vital role played by what they called extra-empirical assumptions in scientific theorizing. We prefer the simpler explanation to the more complicated, the conservative to the more radical, the more general to the more ad hoc. Of course, as Quine noted, these preferences can come into conflict, and as when a radical alteration in a theory would produce an ontological economy or increased generality, and it is unlikely that we will ever have a general normative account of how such trade-offs should be decided. These a priori elements, we should acknowledge, are a type of bias. They incline us in certain directions, and they do so in advance of evidence. They must do so in advance of evidence because we need them in order to get evidence. Without an innate similarity space, we would have to consider every objective parameter of variation as equally important. Our empirical conjectures would be tests of our principles of projection as much as they would be tests of our generalizations. In this way, our innate biases to treat some properties as more important than others is what makes empirical knowledge possible. And one note, there's a kind of ultra-empiricism that holds that such biases, though handy, are not really necessary for the achievement of knowledge. Defenders of this view appeal to the existence of programs that permit huge and crazy fast computers to pull statistical regularities from enormous data sets. This is interesting if what one is interested in is the power of mechanical computation. That's a perfectly legitimate interest to have. But it tells us nothing about the strategies that human beings employ when they successfully infer statistical patterns in naturalistic conditions. If they have neither the power, the time, or the data that are available to the statistical inference engines, then they must be doing it in a different way. So now, way number two, the importance of being biased. The idea that bias has a constructive role to play in the generation of human knowledge really resonated with me and informed not only my work in the philosophy of mind, but also my work in feminism. Feminist epistemologists have been critical of abstract and individualistic models of human knowledge, and I should say that I have nothing against abstraction or individualism at all in general, but I am moved by the call for more situated epistemology. Feminist epistemologists have called for accounts that situate knowledge in a natural and social environment. Quine's naturalized epistemology seemed to me to answer this call. The naturalized approach to the study of individual knowers, the approach that seeks to explain how an individual comes to know what she knows in the circumstances in which she manages to do so, reveals that she is aided by a host of native inclinations, biases, and in some cases by highly specialized learning mechanisms. But insofar as our epistemic achievements rely on these inclinations and mechanisms, they rely as well on a hospitable environment. Our humanly native language acquisition device might not enable us to acquire, say, Klingon, under conditions of casual exposure. The biases that that device embodies, our own language acquisition device, might even impede our efforts to learn Klingon in any other way as well. Maybe there is some argument from evolutionary considerations to the conclusion that we cannot be too poorly attuned to any environment that is nomologically possible. This would be an excellent thing to talk about over drinks, by the way. But we do know that our intuitive physics and kinematics lead us astray when things get much bigger or much smaller or much faster than what we're used to in everyday life. I think the most likely thing is that whenever creatures evolve who can extract information from their environments, they only do so because they utilize some merely satisficing epistemic mechanism, one that yields a lot of information or a lot of useful information while trading off some degree of accuracy. And I think this is the grain or the quarter grain of truth in embodied mentality work. It is in this sense that real actual knowledge is situated. I conjecture that a perfectly safe epistemic strategy does not really exist, at least not for creatures who have to rely on their bodies to find things out. The idea that we human beings rely a lot on fallible biases and heuristics is quite familiar today, due partly to popular books written by social scientists and psychologists like Daniel Kahneman, Gerrit Gigerunzer, and Dan Ariely. This is a glass half empty, half full sort of situation. A fallible heuristic, like Gigerunzer's familiarity heuristic, roughly this is a heuristic that says, when in doubt, pick the one you've heard of, is great when it's applied in the right domain, where familiarity actually co-varies with the property that you're interested in. But it's awfully dangerous if it's applied in the wrong one. The same is true of more general cognitive biases that human beings tend to display, like confirmation bias and one-trial learning. If one is a member of a prey species, as we are, the cost of an epistemic bias that yields lots of false positives for the presence of predators may be more than offset by the benefit of quick judgment when the predator is actually approaching. Sarah Jane Leslie, in her work on generics and natural language, points out that we human beings readily accept a number of generic claims that are in fact true only of a tiny fraction of the group that they cover. For example, ticks carry Lyme disease. We tend to do this, most particularly when the generics involve what Leslie calls dangerous properties. She theorizes that this natural cognitive bias, allowed to operate freely in certain social conditions that encourage in-group, out-group sentiments and dynamics, natural cognitive bias allowed to operate freely in these social conditions may be the source of racist prejudice. So from a naturalized epistemological point of view, individual cognitive biases are neither inherently bad nor inherently good. It all depends on the environment in which the biases are deployed. But I think that we can see that there is the same relativity even when we're talking about epistemic strategies that might seem more robustly reliable, more safe, than the processes that, for example, generate the dangerous property generics. What I have in mind are cognitive strategies for extracting genuine regularities when these strategies are deployed in social environments that have been shaped by injustice. And there are two kinds of cases I want to describe briefly. The first kind involves our accurately tracking the causal consequences of systematic disadvantage. It is not racist to believe that most professional basketball players are black. Quick show of hands, I mean, people think most professional basketball players are black. It's a fact. Nearly 75% of NBA players are African American. Nor is it racist to believe that there are not many black classical musicians. Less than 3% of positions in U.S. symphony orchestras are held by African Americans. And it's not sexist to believe that most philosophers are men. The numbers are clear. 65% or more of academic philosophy jobs are held by men. It is perfectly proper, epistemically, to believe such things on the basis of observation. The problem with such generalizations is not their content, but the significance we assign to them or the inferences we make from them, especially when these extra cognitive steps occur without our conscious notice. Our capacities for generalization often, in general, connect us to natural kinds, that is, to the reliable co-occurrences of observable properties, which often signal the existence of a real essence of property or set of properties that are explanatorily or causally fundamental. But properties that have no inherent, deeper, natural connection with each other can be brought into concordance by extrinsic, contingent forces. In human life, these forces are often social, and they are often reflective of power relations. We go wrong when we uncritically attribute properties like athletic ability, musical ability, philosophical ability to racial or gendered essences. A word on group essences. One could argue, and I would argue, that the belief that there are such things as group essences involves some kind of confusion, whether it's a mistaken reasoning in inferring the explanation of variance for the explanation of cause or something like that, or a false element in folk metaphysics, I don't know. But some race theorists are willing to allow the belief in group essences as innocent on its own. Kwame Anthony Appiah, for example, distinguishes the view that he calls racialism, the belief that there are group essences, from racism, the belief that these group essences lead to differences in the moral character or moral worth of these different groups. In any case, to draw the conclusion that facts like the ones I've cited support claims about inherent ability or any other inherent property neglects the degree to which these regularities reflect systematic inequities in opportunities. I'm a little distracted. Oh no, oh my gosh, uh-oh, well, all right. I'm not gonna jump in. Maybe white men can't jump, but they can play tennis. Only 4 out of the top 100 male players ranked in the, this is an international ranking by the Association of Tennis Professionals, are non-white. Only 4 out of the 100 top male tennis players in the world are non-white. Is it just possible that the difference in accessibility between basketball courts and tennis courts explains most of the demographic variation? Variance. The second sort of case that I want to consider where innocent and epistemically legitimate generalizations can lead us astray involves social feedback loops. Feminist theorists like Marilyn Frey, Catherine McKinnon, and Sally Haslinger, as well as philosophers of social science like Ian Hacking, have described the dynamics of these phenomena in which a message about the character of a dominated class becomes, in a way, self-verifying. Consider the claim that women have no facial hair. Is it true or false? When I ask my undergraduate students, most of them say that it's true. Almost all the men say it's true, and many of the women do too. Now, of course, many women do have facial hair. Many women have quite a lot of facial hair, but this will not be evident from observation in our environment. There is a powerful gender norm for women in contemporary American society that says women ought not to have facial hair. The gender norm against facial hair on a woman is so strong that women who have abundant or dark facial hair go to great lengths to remove it, often at great expense and almost always despite a lot of discomfort. The result? Look around. You will not see many women, if any, with noticeable mustaches, sideburns, or beards. So the generalization seems to be confirmed. Women have no facial hair. And then the more strongly it is confirmed, the more it seems, to many women alike, that a woman who does display facial hair is some kind of statistical outlier, or to put it less kindly, is some kind of freak, not a real woman or not a good woman. The expectation that women will have hairless faces, and while we're on the subject, hairless armpits, hairless legs, hairless other things, now it becomes normative. Women who refuse to deal with their facial hair. These are in quotes because this is language that you'll hear if you look at the, that you'll see if you look at this on the internet. Women who refuse to deal with their facial hair have lost jobs over this, and they have been scolded, ridiculed, and internet shamed. There are similar stories to tell about a great many of the properties that are taken to be natural consequences of being biologically male or biologically female. There is an interplay among normative expectations, the structure of reward contingencies, the behavior that results from these structures, that structure behavior, and the observable regularities, which finally feed back to vindicate the normative expectation. My own view of gender, which I will just note provocatively, used to be considered progressive, but is now regarded by some as reactionary, no questions, is that gender is the output of a system of social constraints that creates an artificial, gender is the output of a system of social constraints and artificial confluences. Gender is the output of a system of social constraints that creates artificial confluences among properties that would otherwise vary independently, a system that we would be better off without. Okay, third way, how reasons move us. I've been pushing an interpretation in naturalistic epistemology according to which the main idea is that all forms of human inquiry are continuous. But this continuity is a matter of mutual constraint, not a matter of methodological identity. There are lots of ways in which things we come to believe through one epistemic mode conflict with things we believe through some different epistemic mode. Common sense tells us that there are material objects, some of which are solid and some of which are colored. Physics tells us that these objects are mostly empty space, and maybe that color is a merely subjective unity. Our linguistic practice allows us to form names that seem to refer to properties. Our logic tells us that if we take this appearance at face value, we will run into contradictions. We have strong intuitions, whatever those are, that certain things are morally wrong, but these intuitions seem to flow free of empirical test. I myself have been grabbed by the apparent conflict between our everyday, ordinary view of ourselves as rational agents, or at least as agents capable of acting on the basis of reason, and the picture that seems to emerge from the biological and psychological sciences that says that we're a bundle of causal mechanisms. This is, of course, the conflict between, as Wilfred Sellers so beautifully put it, the manifest image and the scientific image. Not that Sellers thought there was a conflict. He believed that the two images were not reconcilable, but that that was okay. He was, on my accounting, a methodological dualist. According to him, there's no mutual constraint, no need to reconcile the two images. We are, according to him, simply engaged in different practices when we consider matters as falling within the space of reasons versus considering them as falling within the spaces of causes. This is absolutely not okay, in my opinion. If our practice of assigning and giving reasons serves us well in everyday life, then that is a fact about the world that must be explained. Human beings, whatever else we are material beings, subject to the same physical laws as govern everything else in the universe. Somehow the reasons we have for doing things literally move us. They issue in body motions, and they must be explained. Moreover, our practice of regarding human beings and some non-human animals as rational agents is productive. We can readily make, in an instant, predictions on the basis of assumptions of very minimal rationality that it would take a Laplacian demon an eon to compute. My favorite example is one from Georges Rey. Construct a pathetically easy true-false quiz and administer it to a bunch of undergraduates who you promise to pay $100 if credibly promise to pay $100 if they get a perfect score. Have them record their answers in number two pencils with number two pencils on an optical scan sheet. On the basis of this setup, you will be able to predict the distribution of graphite on 100 sheets of paper with extreme precision. Nice, huh? Notice that this little experiment spans the so-called gap between the space of reasons and the space of causes. Knowing the answers to the questions, understanding how to use an op scan sheet, these are intentional characterizations of things, a placing of matters within the space of reasons. But graphite marks on paper, that space of causes stuff. Yet we are making predictions about the latter on the basis of the former. And so it is with much of our everyday figuring out. The most promising idea for explaining this coordination between reasons and causes, seemed to me early on, one of the first philosophy articles I read, to come from Donald Davidson, Actions, Reasons, and Causes. Reasons could move us, he argued, because reasons were a kind of cause. A reason is a type of mental state, a belief-desire combo called a pro-attitude that is token identical with some brain state. I would prefer to say realized as rather than is token identical with, but let that pass. Qua mental state, the pro-attitude rationalized the action. The action was revealed to be reasonable in light of the agent's belief and desire. Qua brain state, the pro-attitude caused the action. Our friendly neighborhood neurologist could presumably someday trace the physical path between the brain event that was the onset of the pro-attitude and the eventual set of muscle contractions that constituted the action. What a beautiful picture. But then Davidson goes all squishy and announces that there can be no regular, nomologically reliable connections between events typed in mental terms and events typed in physical terms. Nomological slack between the mental and the physical, Davidson wrote, breaking my heart. Not that he cared. Nomological slack between the mental and the physical is necessary as long as we are to conceive ourselves as rational beings. Now, since I was a graduate student in Cambridge in the late 1970s, one of the towering figures I was fortunate enough to encounter was, as I mentioned earlier, Jerry Fodor. Fodor was, and is, all about reconciling our ordinary folk psychology with scientific accounts of the mind, and had a perfectly lovely theory. I'm trying to say that like Jerry. Had a perfectly lovely theory that could do everything that needed doing on this score. According to Fodor, propositional attitude states were A, functional states involving B, relations to sentence-like mental representations, items in a language of thought. Positing such representations explains a lot. Why there are Frege cases, why we don't immediately recognize the truth about every mathematical theorem as soon as we learn that 2 and 2 are 4, not to mention how Oedipus wanted to marry Jocasta without wanting to marry his mother. But returning to the issue immediately at hand, this marriage between Fodor and Davidson seemed to me to be a no-brainer. If we took a realistic view of mental representations, we could explain how mental states can have both rational semantic properties and causal properties. Moreover, we could explain how a mechanism that looks merely causal from the vantage point of physics can nonetheless be disciplined to respect the rational relations among thought contents. Because one, syntax can encode rationally important structure, and two, syntactic structures can be realized in physical structures, and finally, three, there can be physical causal mechanisms that are sensitive to just those physical features that correspond to syntactic features, we can, wait for it, mechanize rationality. What's not to love? Well, Davidson didn't love this picture, and many other philosophers didn't and still don't. If I have any vestiges of my Catholic upbringing, they reside in my evangelical zeal to bring the good news of the language of thought to all humankind. I find that too many of my philosophical brethren and sistren struggle unnecessarily with problems that realism about mental representation just solves. I mentioned Frege problems. Many philosophers, I won't name names, you know who you are, think that Frege problems show the need for complicating our notion of semantic content. Reference, they say, is too coarse-grained. We need finer-grained contents. Or we need ways of constructing contents that mirror the structure of the sentences that express them. But this is to misdiagnose the problem. We don't need more contents or more kinds of content. We need a whole other dimension, something orthogonal to content. Here's the troublesome truth. All of the problems about intentionality, with an S, derive from the fact that there is no guarantee whatsoever that there will be a one-to-one correspondence between things and representations of things. It doesn't matter if your things reside in metaphysically possible worlds, epistemically possible worlds, all possible worlds, or the planet Tatooine. As soon as there's a thing, bingo, there's the possibility of two distinct representations of that thing. And because representations are objects in their own right, I can have a relationship with one of them that I don't have with the other. So I can pick up one representation, but not the other. Or I can pick up both representations and think that they refer to different things. None of this is an accident. nor does it indicate representational malfunction. It is a feature of representation, not a bug, that representations are ontologically, causally, epistemically, and every other way distinct from the things they represent. In fact, they are so completely dependent of the things they represent that there don't even need to be things in order for them to be representations that represent them. Yes, they solve the problem of empty reference, too. Ask me later about the exciting details. You could also ask David Brown, who's here. But getting back to the issue of causes and reasons, why was Davidson so adamantly dualistic about the mental and the physical? He surely didn't think that there was an unbreachable gap between, say, the biological and the chemical. Why did he think that there not only was, but had to be a gap preserved between the mental and the physical? I think that what he was afraid of was this. Suppose we were to discover a robust correlation between a particular belief type and a particular neurological state type, relativized, if you like, to a particular person. So suppose that, so far, whenever I believe that there's a spider in the vicinity, there has been a distinctive pattern of firing in a specific region in my brain, the arachnophobic frontal cortex. It used to be that in order to tell whether I believed there to be a spider in the room, you would have to observe my behavior. You'd ask me if I thought there was a spider, for example, or knowing that I'm severely arachnophobic, you'd see if I was sidling toward the door, or if escape was impossible, screaming. But now it looks like you have a new means at your disposal. You can check the brainoscope and see if the characteristic pattern was occurring. All good, right? Wrong. What if the brainoscope says that I am in the state of believing that there's a spider there, but I'm not screaming, not sidling, and when you ask me if I believe there's a spider, I calmly tell you no? That is, the brainoscopic data are in conflict with the behavioral data, the ordinary marks of belief on which we normally rely and which enable us to make sense of each other's actions and inactions. If we allow the neurological facts to override the behavioral facts, we violate the precepts that define the very notion of belief. Now, this would be disconcerting, I concede. Just as disconcerting as it would be if a surgeon opened the head of an intelligent human being and found that her skull was completely empty. If such a thing were to happen, I think it would be epistemically appropriate to reconsider our commitment to the physicalistic idea that human intelligence depends on our having brains. But it's not going to happen, because human intelligence does depend on our having brains. So we don't have to worry about it. The conceivability of such a thing happening is not, in itself, an argument against materialism. And I think even Joe Levine agrees with me about this. My response to Davidson, then, is that he needn't worry. I can modus ponens his modus tollens. One, our folk psychological criteria for the possession of mental states are reliable. Two, we have excellent reason to think that mental states are realized by neurological states. So therefore, three, our folk psychological criteria will not come into conflict with our neurological data. As the geologist Thomas Burnett wrote to Isaac Newton in another context, Newton was worried that Burnett's cyclical theory of geological development was at odds with the account that was accepted of the development of the world in Genesis. As Thomas Burnett wrote to Isaac Newton in another context, the truth cannot be an enemy to the truth. Now, I'm prepared to put money down on this, and so should anyone who really believes that folk psychology works. For extra confidence, let me throw in this additional consideration. The development of our reductive account of mental states is going to be constrained by folk psychology. We won't believe a theory that makes folk psychology come out wrong any more than we would believe a reductive physical theory that tells us that boiling water is colder than ice. Now, I should have been putting little ceteris paribus clauses all over the place back there, but a little slippage is okay. Even Davidson agrees that we sometimes have to treat someone as irrational. That is, sometimes the constitutive principles of belief attribution can be thwarted a little now and then without these disastrous consequences about giving up our belief in rational agency occurring. If that's okay, then a little slippage now and then between neurological and behavioral evidence shouldn't be a problem either. Conclusion. I started with the admission for some time I did philosophy without really knowing what it was I was doing. So what have I learned about philosophy that I didn't know before? Well, I've argued that philosophy is continuous with science and that philosophy is continuous with common sense. But what is philosophy? My meta philosophy, such as it is this. Philosophy is distinctively synoptic. Philosophy is the discipline that surveys all the things that we think are true and tries to figure out how they can be true together. It might not work. We might have to give up some cherished beliefs. We might end up in places we have wanted like anything to avoid. But then again, we might succeed. A well-known philosopher I was talking to once told me that he admired my work for its optimism. At the time, I took this as damnation with faint praise. Brilliant, you know, optimistic. That might have been right. But now I think it's maybe just a fair description. My mother often used to say to me when I was a child, Louise, you just can't expect things to always make sense. Well, that's exactly what I expect, and that's why I do philosophy. Thank you.
There is a wine and cheese.